Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. And as always, I'm so glad that you could join me for a little bit today as we dive into the cardboard boxes and binders and plastic pages and top loaders and you name it. And we're on the search for some classic cardboard. And speaking of searches, it was a search on eBay that gave me a Jim Mora moment a few weeks ago. You know what I'm talking about. Jim Mora Sr., not Jr., but Jim Mora Sr., not necessarily known for his success as a head coach. He did have several good seasons in New Orleans. But he's better known for some of the outbursts and crazy sound bites that he produced. And as somebody who has spent pretty much all my life in sports broadcasting, and especially a pretty good chunk of it early on in my career as a sports talk show producer and host, my life is sound bites. I will hear a certain word or a certain line in a song, and I will immediately think back to a particular sound bite of a person or a sports play, a moment in history. Like even the word playoffs, you know, you hear about a team clinching the playoffs or about to clinch a playoff berth, and the first thing you think of is actually Jim Mora Sr. when he was with the Colts in the late 90s going, playoffs? You kidding me? Playoffs? Don't talk about playoffs. And Mora had a lot of great sound bites like that, the playoff tirade. There was another one where he used the term diddly poo, which in and of itself is entertaining, but when you hear a grown man use it in public to describe his football team's effort or lack thereof in a press conference, that makes it worth its weight in gold. And, you know, he was just railing fans in New Orleans when their quarterback got hurt in the game, you know, late in his tenure with the Saints. He's full of a lot of them. But there's one that often goes overlooked because the playoff one takes the cake and then diddly poo and all the others. But there's one that often gets overlooked. And it's the Jim Mora experience that I had a couple weeks ago when I was on eBay. And this stems from a press conference that Mora held, I think it was in the 1989 season. You know, he had come into New Orleans in 86, turned the Saints around. Suddenly they were actually, I wouldn't say a contending team, but for the first time in their 20-plus year history, they were actually a team that could finish above 500. And in that season, the Saints were struggling to live up to expectations. They were up and down, win-loss, win-loss, win-loss. So after one game in his press conference, Mora mostly addressing the media, but then eventually kind of spreading the blame to fans and just people who weren't named Jim Mora. When somebody was asking about the Saints' effort and how they were missing blocks and not doing this route right and that route right, Mora delivered the beauty, where he says, "You know, you think you know, but you don't know. You don't know how it is. You think you know, but you don't know." And it's one of the best self-owning comments where Mora is trying to heap it on the media. Well, you don't play this game. You don't coach this game, so you don't know what's going on. But in his attempt to basically trash the media, he started, you know, kind of circular firing squad on himself. You know, you think you know, but you don't know. And if you did know, then you would know. And, it was almost from the Yogi Berra gospel. And my "you think you know, but you don't know" experience happened a couple of weeks ago. I'm on eBay, and I'm looking for some packs to open up on the show. And when you do a show like this, you try to mix it up a little bit. Nothing wrong with doing a repeat pack break or a repeat set. You know, we've done it. Yeah, in the 3 years I've been doing this podcast, you know, I've covered practically every major set release since 1949. So there's only so much you can do that's original. Yeah, sometimes you have to circle back, or you have to take a little bit of a different view on a particular card or set or unique little part of the hobby. So I got on this idea. Well, let me look for differently packaged cards. And, you know, maybe we could just have some fun with, you know, different packs of cards. Because really, ever since the early 80s, and certainly ever since I started collecting in the late 80s, packaging of baseball cards has been pretty standard. You have your wax pack. You have your cello pack. Of course, now they're called fat packs, but you have your cello pack. You have your rack pack, which you don't really see that much these days. You have your complete set, and, you know, more of releases from the past, say, 8 or 9 years. You've got your blaster packs, you know, the ones that have 35 cards, or the blaster boxes that have, you know, 8 packs in it. And I'm talking about retail. Of course, you've got the hobby level packs and boxes that are out there too. But, you know, for the most part, in the past, I would say 35 years, card packaging has been pretty standardized in terms of wax, cello, rack, and then more recently, you've got the blaster packs and boxes. But it hasn't really changed that much. Well, in the late 70s and early 80s, Topps in particular had to come up with some creative packaging for a number of reasons. One, for economic reasons. As we've discussed, there were a lot of economic challenges that Topps had to go head-to-head with in the mid to late 70s. And then by 1981, you had the competitive challenges with Fleer and Donruss entering the market. Topps had to find different ways to distribute its product. And even though the product was much more established and much better than what Fleer and Donruss would produce for the next 3 or 4 years, Topps still had to think out of the box a little bit to come up with different ways of getting their product out front first so that people didn't really give the time of day to the competition. And that's how I stumbled upon this rather unique pack. I had never seen it before. I thought I knew, but I didn't know, to paraphrase Jim Mora. I saw this 1981 Topps Super Pack. I went, oh, what's this? And what stood out was not necessarily the name, but how it was packaged. The Super Pack was basically a cello pack, but the bubble gum that would normally come in a cello pack was wrapped in its own packaging, and it was attached to the bottom of the cello pack. And what jumped out to me at this was, holy cow, I can actually get a pack of 81 Topps cards and not worry about gum stains. That's pretty amazing. You know, that's the worst part about any kind of vintage cards, is that the bubble gum is, you know, either stuck to the cards or it's got this big old stain on a star card or whatever. And the card is basically worthless because it's got this big stain or this big hunk of gum on it. And here was something that was actually pretty neat. Wow, Topps actually packaged the bubble gum to be separate from the cards. And you still had the same number of cards in the Super Pack as you did a cello pack. There were 28 cards back then. And I was able to get it, thanks through the generous donations of our listeners, I was able to get it pretty affordably and had it sent over. And we actually opened it up yesterday. So if you go on to YouTube and type in Wax Ecstatic Super Pack Break, you'll see that break. You'll see the gum. And you'll also see some of the cards that we pulled out of there. And it was very interesting to, first of all, have a nearly, I don't want to say mint. Let me put it this way. No gum stains on the cards, because the pack wasn't necessarily mint in the sense that, yeah, the cards weren't damaged in any way. But there were some off-center cards there, so I don't want to necessarily call it a mint pack. But you didn't have any damage from the typical cello pack packaging of 1981. You didn't have any damage from the bubble gum. And it was actually kind of neat to open up a cello pack and not have to worry about that type of stuff. And it made me wonder, why didn't Tops keep doing that? Especially since they held the market on the bubble gum back in the early 80s. So we're going to dive into that a little bit. Talk about some of the players. Of course, I pull four players from the pack. And we had some great 80s baseball names that we're going to feature as our pulled players. We've got a Champ. We've got a Krukow. We've got a, let's see, who else did we get? We've got a good old Damaso. So we're going to dive into some of those. We also have a Klutz. You can't have great 80s baseball cards without having a Klutz. But anyways, you know, we'll pull out a few of the cards and talk about some of the players that are in there. But also, I did eat the gum, and it was actually not that bad. Now, I can say this because about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I had some kind of stomach bug where any liquid that was in my body was coming out of every orifice of my body. So, you know, having survived that for a rather torrid 24 hours, I figured, well, sure, I could eat the gum. So I will give you a report card on the bubble gum, as well as the pack, and we'll look into why Tops did that and why they stopped doing that. It's a little bit of a mystery, and perhaps a way for Tops to market the card again and all the retro craze, you know, a good way of marketing their cards, although, you know, the bubble gum is a completely different aspect of today's card collecting, and the Topps company as well. They don't make the bubblegum anymore. So we'll dive into that in just a little bit. Also, because it is July 4th weekend as this podcast is being released, if there's one thing I've learned over the last few years, it's that nobody listens to anything on July 4th. So we're going to keep this show rather light, probably a little shorter than normal. Of course, every time I say that, it runs an hour and a half. But, you know, we're going to keep it light. We're going to address a couple of questions that came up through our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stain. So we'll go ahead and take care of that today as well. First of all, we need to take care of some housekeeping, as we like to do. Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. So our next show will be coming your way on Friday, July the 19th. It will be released at noon Eastern via our home base at audioboom.com. But you can get it in a number of ways, including downloading, subscribing the feed at iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and also Spotify. And there are assorted other ways and RSS feeds that link up to the program. So however you listen, please continue to do so and share it with your friends. Also, if you have the chance to rate the podcast by commenting on it or giving it a certain number of stars, or, you know, however you get your podcast, there's some kind of rating system, please do, because what that does is, the more specifically, and I want you to be honest here, but from most of the reviews I've seen, it's been positive responses. But the more positive responses you have, the more stars you click on, the more comments you make, it changes the algorithm for something like an iTunes or an iHeartRadio, however you're listening. And basically what happens is, the more positive feedback the show gets, it gets bumped up the ladder of podcasts throughout that platform. And as you know, there are tens of thousands of podcasts out there. So any assistance that you can provide with that commentary is always appreciated. What is also appreciated is your donations. Again, I was able to get that super PAC through some generous donations from a couple of listeners over the last few weeks. Thank you, thank you, thank you for those who have made a donation. If you haven't yet and you find it in your heart to pull together just a few bucks, you can make your donations to paypal.me/waxecstatic. And Wax Ecstatic is all one word, by the way. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. Whether it's just a few dollars or maybe 20 bucks or even more, God bless you if that's your case. But if you make any kind of donation, it goes back to the program in two ways. One, through the maintenance of not only the live shows, the quote-unquote live shows, the new shows, but our archive as well. We have over 130 podcasts from over the past 3 years, so we like to keep the archive up and running as people discover the show and they go back and pick and choose to listen to shows from the past about certain sets or certain players that we discuss. And also, in the purchasing of the products that you hear on this show. So I can go out and I can make that purchase for an 81 top super pack without having to sweat a little bit. And it makes for an interesting conversation piece here. And like I was saying before, you know, I sometimes have to circle back and, you know, pick up some packs and cards from sets that we've talked about in the past. I can't, you know, as much as I'd love to buy, say, Series 5 72 top set and open it up on the show, you know, unless I've got $500 in my pocket, I can't do that. So every little bit counts. And as I've mentioned before, any product where I have excess, so let's say that I open up a box of cards on a show and I've decided, well, I don't want to, you know, have these take up space in my house, then what we do is we package them up and send them off to two rather yeoman-like workforces, Kidorty Cards and Commons for Kids, two businesses that will take your leftover baseball cards and repackage them and redistribute them to children. The next package, which I would imagine is probably going to go out in a few weeks, will be going to Commons for Kids. And again, they take all your commons, whether it's new cards or older cards, and they will repackage them and hand them off to children as little gifts. That is awesome. Also, Kidorty Cards, we've had them on the program before. They will take the cards, organize them by teams, and if your child wants to have a monthly baseball pack, if you will, a card pack from his or her favorite team, it will be delivered through Kidorty Cards. Very small fee to have that done. So let's say your child's a big fan of the Phillies. Well, your child will get not only new cards from the Phillies, but especially if I've got some dupe 81 Topps cards from a super pack like this, it may end up in his or her collection, which is very, very cool. You know, we often get wrapped up in the idea of sending out new cards to kids. Well, some kids, they like to hold that old card as well and look at the old pictures and make fun of the old uniforms or the porn stashes that baseball players typically had in the 70s and 80s. So again, the products that we purchase, and once we, you know, unwrap them all and share them all, if there's any excess, we just say, all right, let's package them up and send them off to one of two places that do a great job of keeping kids in the hobby. Again, Commons for Kids and Kidorty Cards. So know that your money, when you donate it, it's going to a good cause here, not just entertaining you with this program, but also continuing to give the gift of baseball cards to children. And it keeps them locked into the hobby, locked into the sport, and gets them interested in things that more than likely will not get them in trouble. Now, our Twitter timeline is at Wax and Gum Stains, and we've got a lot of fun stuff that pops up there every now and then. So again, share that as well with your friends if you haven't already. Give us a follow. That is where you will first see the links to videos and the links to podcasts. And we always have a fun time, a lot of great conversations, questions pop up, and sometimes we'll run a poll there about what we should discuss on the show or which packs we should open up. So give us a follow on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, speaking of Wax and Gum Stains, some comments that have come across the timeline over the past few weeks. First of all, my thanks to everybody who has reached out to me regarding the passing of my father, Kevin, back on May 15th, and the Father's Day show that we did a few weeks ago in my father's memory. I want to thank Doug and Nick and Shane for your commentary and condolences as well. Also, John Rubiner as well. So, John, thank you so much for chiming in and offering your condolences. I really appreciate it. Now, we had C.D. Anderson asking me, well, first of all, noticing that the last show was a bit adult-themed. And I thought, well, 92 Fleer wasn't all that bad. And then I realized, oh, wait, you know, I'd mentioned the empty calorie feeling. And, well, we've all been there where, you know, you kind of fall in love with a girl and you know, almost have like a one-night stand thing, and everyone's done it. I do want to mention, CD, that was premarital bliss days for me. This isn't something, I'm not gallivanting out here. I'm not a Don Juan nowadays. But when I was younger and a little more carefree, we had those empty calorie date nights, if you know what I mean. But yeah, it's definitely not an issue now. Married, couple of kids. I'm doing a podcast on baseball cards, so there is no secret Sean Connery, James Bond angle to my life here. But anyways, CD mentions that Fleer really went off the rails in 91 to 93. Terrible looking sets. 1994, really underrated. I got to take a look back at 94 because I had pretty much stopped collecting new cards in 94. But I got to take a look back at the 94 design. He also mentions, do you use sports lots to finish your sets? Actually, I don't, but it is something that I will consider at the very least to finish off those sets that I have, maybe three or four cards to get, and they're common cards. And I think he brings this up because I mentioned in 91 Tops, I opened up the 91 Tops cello box a few shows ago, and I'd been collating a 91 Tops set and had, I think, like two or three cards left. So that is definitely a shotgun approach to completing a set when you have two or three cards to go and you open up a box. So rather than spend $20 on a box, just spend, you know, maybe 10 cents on three cards. But one reason why I don't go out and, you know, just buy a handful of cards here and there to complete sets is that there is still a thrill for me in opening up packs and opening up boxes. And again, from a fiscal standpoint, it makes much more sense to spend a dollar or less to get that handful of cards mailed to me. But there's still a thrill in opening up the boxes. So again, I do have a couple of sets that I've been hand collating that, you know, I'm getting under 20 cards left to complete them. So I may use a resource like Sports Lots, or there's plenty of other providers on eBay that'll charge you 2 cents a card as long as it's a common card, and they'll help you complete the sets. But because I still had that thrill of opening up boxes and opening up packs, I don't quite use that method too often. All right, nice comment here from DNC Card Breaks. Just found your podcast and enjoying binging the episodes, he said, particularly the Junk Wax early episodes. Glad you enjoy those. Do you take any listener requests? Would love to hear a general episode on Beckett price guides. I still have so many from the late 80s. Well, DNC Card Breaks, thank you so much for connecting with the program. I'm glad you're enjoying listening to the Junk Wax era shows, even some of the first shows that we did. And I think it's part of 90s nostalgia. People just love the 90s right now. So, you know, everyone's kind of going back to some of those card sets from the late 80s and early 90s and enjoying them a little more than they did, back then even. But certainly once the card hobby got too gluttonous and people just kind of stashed away their 90s baseball cards. So I'm glad you're finding some joy in that. Do I take listener suggestions and requests? Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, several of our shows have been based on listener requests, and I still have a little list of listener requests that if I can fulfill them, I'm kind of weaving them into the program here, try to mix it up just a little bit from show to show. So yeah, if you have any requests, you're more than welcome to send them. And I love your request about the Beckett magazines, and I'm adding that to the list. And I've actually, I've been a guest on the Beckett podcast. Now, this is a couple of years ago, but I do have some connections over at Beckett. We can see if there's somebody who can join us to talk about the Beckett magazines. And I remember Beckett magazine. I mean, that was the Bible of pricing. You just could not, in the pre-internet days, you could not get around the Beckett Baseball Monthly Guide. And that was gospel. That was, when it came into your local card shop, the dealer would keep one copy and mark it up, like store copy, and keep it behind the counter. And there was a cottage industry just in Beckett Baseball Card Monthly. Like certain magazines, if you had them in mint condition, people would buy them. You know, now, much like the hobby, you know, the value of those has dropped down a little bit. But I know when Beckett launched the hockey guide in 1989 or 90, you know, Wayne Gretzky was featured on the cover. Well, of course, everybody snapped up those issues, I should say, and resold them, you know, for $5, $6, $8, what have you. And there's still a market for them because, you know, most card guides, you use them and then chances are you threw them out I hung on to them. And I hung on to them for a while. And I had a subscription to Beckett for probably 3 or 4 years in the early 90s. And I looked forward to that coming in the mail. There was only one other magazine that I looked forward to more than Beckett Monthly Guide. That was Sports Illustrated, especially the swimsuit issue, but that's another topic for another time. But, you know, the Beckett would come in and you would automatically, you know, look it up and find, you know, your 10 or 20 most valuable cards and you would see if they had gone up. And nothing was more depressing than finding that one of your more cherished cards went down in value. You know, let's say you had like the 88 Donruss Roberto Alomar rookie and you're like, it's his rookie card. And it was valued at $5 one month. Well, you open up one issue and all of a sudden it's $3.50. You're like, what? It's just been sitting on my shelf here. How could it go down? There was nothing more depressing than seeing some of your favorite cards drop in value, but it was pretty interesting to see things go up. And also because, again, this was pre-internet days, in many ways, the pictures of the cards that they used to have at the top of each set, that was a neat way of seeing what the cards looked like because, you know, you didn't have the internet to just type in, you know, 73 Tops baseball and you could see all the types of cards. You know, that was how you saw them if you didn't actually have them in your own collection. So, you know, they also had some very interesting articles in there. But, you know, that price guide, that was the thing for many, many years in the early 90s. And of course, the internet came around and eventually by the late 90s, once the hobby had cooled off significantly, there were much easier ways to get prices and also coordinate your set online. And, you know, there's kind of a missing feeling not getting that Beckett every month. But yeah, I remember those days where you looked forward to it, you knew kind of which day of the month or which week of the month it would arrive in the mail, and you eagerly anticipated it. And especially in the spring, too, because they would preview the baseball card sets, and you would be able to see the new card sets if you hadn't seen them in person at your local card shop or a card show. You got to see them in Beckett. Now, even though most collectors threw them out, I hung on to them for many years, trying to think how many I had. I probably had like 50 of them at least. And finally, several years ago, you know, my mother's cleaning out various storage spaces and rooms in her house. And she says, here, take these with you. And what do you know? There's a cardboard box filled with Beckett price guides, and they are not in mint condition. They are quite used because, again, you know, I was a teenager. I used it as a price guide. I didn't use it as a collectible, with very few exceptions. Like I got Nolan Ryan to autograph a Beckett from, I think, late 1991 or early 1992. It's Nolan Ryan wearing his, you know, his chaps. You know, it's Nolan Ryan the cowboy, not Nolan Ryan the Hall of Fame pitcher. So, you know, most of the price guides, they just kind of went into a box and sat there for about 20 years. So I'm looking at this cardboard box of these used price guides. I'm like, okay, what am I going to do with these? Like, I'm not going to sell them. Who the hell wants to buy them? And it's not like I'd be able to get much anyways. So what I did, as I'm thumbing through them, I had a better appreciation for the photography and in some cases the artwork that was featured on the covers and not just the outer cover, but the inner cover as well, front and back. So basically, I just took the covers off all the magazines, threw out the newsprint portion, and I still have the covers of the magazines stored away in a closet. And one of these days, when I'm rich and famous, I will perhaps frame some of these, because there are some great photographs that were in there, and again, some great artwork. I remember, I think it was Beckett's 100th issue. I may be wrong on the number there, but there was a particular milestone issue with some great artwork of Jackie Robinson on the front cover. And on the back cover, it was Nolan Ryan holding a birthday cake with, like, you know, happy 100th Beckett or something like that on there. I kept those, but I don't have the rest of the magazines. And, you know, that's something that's changed in me personally as I've gotten older. And perhaps, you know, living in Florida, I see practically on every street corner these U-Store places. Maybe it's just because I'm getting older, but I'm like, people, just throw your stuff out. You know, we all carry around so much junk that there is a cottage industry of, you know, stuff places. George Carlin had a great line about that. You know, we have so much stuff, we have to buy a building to hold our stuff. You know, there's not enough room for our stuff in our homes. So now we have to rent space for our stuff, and we just have too much stuff. So, you know, the Beckett price guides were stuff in my world. So I got rid of them, except for some of the photographs and the artwork. Nice comment here from Robert Lawson. I recently began collecting leaders cards and star pairings, an easy way to collect Hall of Famers and near Hall of Famers on the cheap. And he included a picture of several cards from the 1950s and 60s. I see a couple from the early 70s here. That's kind of like the dreaded manager card. You know, some people, and I've even done this too, you know, you get the manager card of Ted Williams or Billy Martin or Gil Hodges because it's a lot easier to afford one of those cards as opposed to the player card. You know, it's a lot easier to get your hands on a Yogi Berra manager card, you know, with the Yankees in the early 80s rather than the, you know, a Yogi Berra player card from the 1950s. But yeah, that is a great way. And you know, I've even seen those in bargain bins. You can get them even for 50 cents, you know, your 1965 ERA leaders or whatever. And it's, you know, it's Jim Palmer and Steve Carlton and Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale, you know, all these great pitchers. And same thing with home run hitters and MVP vote getters. So a great find there, Robert. Glad that you're enjoying that. John Rubiner, along with the condolences to my family, added, "Your Father's Day show made me recall the days with my dad watching Red Wings hockey. Thanks. Also, what's your take on the trimming / grading issue? And I'd love a hockey card show." Well, John, I would love a hockey card show as well. However, that is just venom to a lot of our listeners. And I say that because a couple of years ago, not once, but twice, I put out polls to see, you know, what direction our listeners wanted to take the show in, because, you know, the show started just this idea of me going through primarily 1980s baseball cards. And then when we got to the end of my 80s and 90s collection, I'm like, well, what now? And you know, we asked the question, well, where should this go? And one of the options was to do hockey shows. And I could do a hockey card show, you know, essentially along the same lines of going back to, I think I've got cards from the late 60s, you know, all the way up to the early 90s, you know, essentially the same time span as my baseball card collection, get up to around 93 or 94. But there were a lot of people who just did not want that. With hockey cards, you have to be a hockey fan, or you have to be living in a hockey market, a place that appreciates hockey, to really appreciate a hockey card show. So, yeah, I, you know, part of me says, boy, that'd be kind of neat to do, but I know the vast majority of our listeners don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. So I think we'll put that in the idea hopper. And one day when I have the ability to do more than one show, then perhaps we branch off and do a hockey show for the rather niche audience that wants that. Now, as for grading and trimming, that is certainly the scandal of our times, isn't it? In fact, I think just a few weeks ago, there's a major fallout from PSA and a card auctioning company. I forget the name of it, but there is a supplier. I forget his name, and I certainly don't want to give him any glory or notification here. But there is a person who was long suspected of trimming cards and doctoring cards and selling them off on eBay. Finally, it just too much happened here, where too many trimmed and altered cards got out into the market. And for the most part, people early on were kind of turning a blind eye to it, but it just kind of became its own monster. And you recently had PSA saying, we're not grading these. You've had the wholesaler going, all right, we're not going to auction these off. And supposedly law enforcement is involved. And the companies who have said, we're not selling these, we apologize if you bought any of these, they're not saying what law enforcement was involved, but considering these were probably not just sales to the local neighborhood and they crossed interstate boundaries, that's when you get, you know, the FBI involved and you know, the FTC. I mean, there's a whole lot of government alphabet soup that gets involved there. So the person who was spearheading the trimming and sales of these cards is in deep doo-doo or diddly-poo, as Jim Morrow would say, because there could be some major crimes here. Now, doctoring cards, there's nothing new about doctoring cards. In fact, I remember when I was a kid, the big concern was black border cards were being doctored by Sharpie markers. You know, the black border cards, in particular, like 87 Donruss, 85 Donruss, but also 71 Tops. With the black borders, you know, you had a little wear and tear. It would show up very easily. So if you were very delicate with a Sharpie marker, you could, at least on, you know, the appearance of a naked eye, make it look like it was in mint condition, or those little dents and imperfections were not there. Now, again, that's to the naked eye. You know, for a trained professional, they can sense that out pretty easily. But trimming has been an issue for at least a good 10 or 15 years, at least, this round of it. And, you know, you can actually thank the grading systems for doing this. You know, the PSAs and the BCG, you know, everybody, speaking of alphabet soup, because there is a higher premium attached to professional grading of cards, if you can get that rare PSA 9 or 10 of a vintage card, it can be worth tens of thousands of dollars, depending on who it is. And even the cards that grade out at a 6 or a 7, depending on who it is and what set it is, and the overall condition of the rest of the card, you can still sell some of these cards for a few hundred bucks. But, you know, like I said, it apparently just too much was going on, in the sense that, what starts as just a few cards here or there, it snowballs. You know, you overlook it, you don't think about it, and then it's too late. You know, it's kind of like an illness. It really is. It's like, you know, one person in a crowded elevator sneezes and nobody seems to care. Well, they sneeze again. And again and again. Well, what do you know? All of a sudden, within a couple of days, everybody in that elevator is sick. If you've ever flown commercial anytime in the last 20 years, you know what that's like. You know, there's that one asshole, behind you, who's just coughing throughout the entire 3-hour flight, and you're sitting there going, oh, great. Yeah. I'm going to get sick here. All right, wonderful. Thanks. And because of the recycled air in the airplane, you know, that one guy who, you know, had to get on that plane gets everybody sick. So, that's the same thing. You know, there's this one guy who's putting one card at a time into the marketplace, and some people aren't as careful. Some people aren't asking questions. Some people are turning a blind eye. And before you know it, there's thousands of these cards out there, and it becomes a problem trying to police it and trying to figure out what is legit and what isn't. That's what's been, you know, hounding the autographed merchandise sector for many, many years now, decades now, is that there are so many imposters out there because so many people didn't really you know, authenticate stuff. You've got some more phonies than real legitimate autographs that are floating out there. So it's unfortunate, but this is part of the business, it's part of life too. You're always going to find somebody who's going to try to find that edge. And while there's nothing wrong with finding an edge or an advantage, it's very easy to cross that line between finding an edge or an advantage to just absolutely taking somebody to the cleaners and doing so in an illegal fashion, and you know that you're doing it illegally. So it's, it's kind of like the words of caution that I offer up to unopened wax. And that is, if you're shopping around, especially on eBay, and you're not seeing these items, you're not holding them in your hand, look at, what I call a trusted dealer. Look at the user feedback. If it's not 100%, don't buy it. If somebody's got 38, customer feedback ratings and the customer feedback's at 94%, that means three or four people didn't like the experience. Don't buy it. if the picture of the pack is taken from 3 feet away, don't buy it. If the pictures are blurry, if they're upside down, if they're kind of dark, don't buy it. Same thing with cards, vintage cards. And it's not even vintage, sometimes it's newer cards too. I'm sure there's quite a few trimmed Ohtani cards from last year that are out there because, it's in packaging. These cards, they get dropped, they get shuffled around in shipping. You have somebody go out there and they take a razor to it and they try to make it a PSA 10 and they try to game the system. So anytime you're going to spend a ton of money on one particular card or maybe a collection of particular cards, be very careful. If you're buying it online, if you're not holding it in your hand to inspect, make sure there's a return policy. Make sure you've got insurance on the card. Make sure that you're not literally spending your mortgage on a handful of cards that may or may not be legit. And if you're at a show or if you're at a card shop, take a close look at it. And especially if you're looking to invest a lot of money, like let's say you're going out to buy a 56 Hank Aaron, that's a significant investment if it's in decent condition. You're going to spend, if it's, a near mint card or anything close to that, you're going to spend a few thousand dollars here. So if you're going to go out and spend that money, go ahead and spend I don't know how much they cost, but they can't be that much, few dollars, for a magnifying glass. Get the jeweler's monocle. Spend that money and, if you bring that into a card shop or you're at a show and you've got this device to really analyze the card, the seller should not be put off by it. If the seller has a legitimate specimen that he or she is selling, they should be totally fine with you inspecting it even further with that magnifying glass. So, just be cautious if you go out there and are prepared to spend a lot of money on one card or a handful of cards. You don't want to get that phony card or that trimmed up card and it just wrecks your collection. And then, you get one bad card and then you're looking at your whole collection and going, well, geez, what else is bad? So I am not quite in the tax bracket to go out and spend a few thousand dollars on a card. So if you're looking for more information about trimming and altering cards, there are some experts out there who do give advice in particular about just bringing a ruler, checking the dimensions of a card, laying one card on top of the other. But again, with the magnifying glass or the jeweler's monocle, looking at the threads, especially older cards, they do not have perfect borders. So you should not expect a perfectly shaved border on a 58 Topps card because, the card is over 60 years old. It's going to have a tiny bit of wear and tear, even if it was kept in very good condition over the decades. So yeah, it's a bit of a scourge on the hobby, but it's cliche to say it is what it is, but it's been introduced. The peel is off the banana. You can't put it back in. You can't completely eliminate it, much like phony autographs, much like steroids in baseball. You know, the PED era started 30 years ago in baseball. It's never, ever going to completely go away. And there will always be question marks as to certain records set and careers made or broken because of PEDs. Likewise with cards, you know, you just need to be extra, extra cautious and vigilant if you're going out and purchasing cards or sets or packs that seem too good to be true. And I think that's the general rule of thumb. You know, if you're at a show and you see a 56 Topps Hank Aaron that looks to be in remarkable condition and is only going for $500, that should raise a red flag. There's something going on there, because nobody is that eager to get rid of a card like that for so little. But if they can make $500 off a card that, because it was altered, is only valued at maybe $50, they will gladly do it. Now, on the same hand, you can get some great deals if you don't mind having altered cards. You can get some great deals because they are altered and the price is driven down if you just want to say, hey, I got a 56 Hank Aaron. Well, you can do that. But most people, nah, they don't want to do that. So now, I'm using 56 as an example just because it popped into my head. I was thinking of the infamous Willie Mays action shot that's in the background. Of course, you know, the 54 Topps Hank Aaron is worth a little more, but you catch my drift. Most of this altering of cards is going to be done to cards that on the surface are worth a lot of money. You're probably not going to have your you know, your 56 Topps Windy McCall is probably not going to be altered that much, simply because even though a common card from that set can fetch a few dollars in good condition, it's not going to be quite as fetching as some of the other more established cards. So thanks for all the questions and suggestions at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Really appreciate it. And again, Wax and Gum Stains is always open with your questions and your thoughts 24/7. All right, let's take a look at this 81 Topps Super Pack. And again, I found this on eBay and was just kind of befuddled because I thought I'd known everything about packaging of cards. And then I saw this and I thought, wow, this is pretty unique. And again, the Super Pack was basically the cello pack with a pack of bubble gum attached to the bottom of the baseball cards. And there are still a few of these around on eBay. You can get them for, let's see, the 81 Topps was going for about $20. And I know there are some from 1980. Those are a little higher because of the Ricky Henderson rookie. But still, you can find some of these on eBay or at local card stores, although there is some scarcity to them because what first started as just a test product for Topps, they didn't run with it very long. And that in and of itself is actually very interesting. While I was doing some research on this, the Topps Super Pack actually got its birth in the mid-70s. Now, remember, and we talked a lot of detail of this several months ago when we did our program on the 75 Topps mini set. Topps was experimenting in the mid-70s with different ways to deliver baseball cards to answer the challenging economic times of the mid-70s. And everybody was doing this, but Topps really had to do this because baseball itself was kind of suffering through a malaise. You know, football was starting to become the sport of the United States, and Topps was trying to find a way to keep its baseball card, you know, on the front burner, but also trying to move product while also trying to save money. So several examples include the elimination of the multi-series sets. Starting in 1974, the set was released in one series, and that was to reduce the often end-of-the-year overabundance of cards. Series 4, 5, and 6 of a set typically were not bought up in large numbers by wholesalers. They often weren't sold in large numbers, you know, at the retail level. So you had a lot of leftover product, and nobody, you know, you didn't want in 1973 baseball cards from 1972. Same thing happens today. You'll see, you know, 2017 and 2018 Topps baseball cards in a clearance shelf if you go to your Walmart or Target, as the case may be, and they'll mark it down. You know, the blaster boxes that normally sell for $19.99, they're going for $12.97 or whatever it is, just to clear the product off the shelf. Well, you know, Topps did that starting in 74. They also started retailing the complete set first through catalogs, and eventually you could get it through card shops, and even retail now you can still get complete sets in that method. So that's one way to move product. Another way to move product was to alter the number of cards in a pack. So you offered up variety. Okay, you can get the 10 card pack for, you know, 15 cents, or you've got a 5-card pack for 10 cents, or they would throw in these 2-card packs into the fun packs that you would get. And that's, you know, another thing that we'll get to in a little bit. So, you know, different size wax packs. Topps also reused wax wrappers, believe it or not. In 1974, or rather 1976, Topps decided to go with the red wrapper again. And they had a bunch left over from 1974. So since it didn't say 1974 on the front of the wrapper, they just reused it. So there are some 76 Topps wax packs that say 660 cards in one set at the bottom of the wrapper. So there can be some confusion nowadays. You know, you think you're getting a 76, but it might be a 74 or vice versa. So, you know, Topps would come around and put out a 1976 series edition of the wrapper. But, you know, they were recycling back then. They made the cardstock thinner, which is why Topps cards from the late 70s are a little more prone to layering than the cards from the early 70s. Also, you had the mini set that came out. And as I mentioned, the fun packs, if Topps had any leftover inventory, what they would do is they would take, say, 3 or 4 packs from a basketball set and put them into a plastic bag with 3 or 4 packs from the Buck Rogers set, 3 or 4 packs from the Star Wars set. Yeah, you know, they would just basically take a handful of packs from other sets that they had produced that year, and they would just put it in a plastic bag and sell the whole bag for, you know, $5 or something like that. And you could still find the fun packs online nowadays. They are a little more than $5 because it all depends what is inside those bags, but that's a fun buy for people too. So Topps is trying to come up with these innovative ways to save money to keep the product going out in the market. And that's how the Super Pack was born. The Super Pack was actually originally a hodgepodge of cards. They would take, you know, leftover baseball and football and hockey and basketball cards and just package them in these 28 card cello packs and just put them out there. Now, this was a test product, so you didn't see a whole lot out there. There aren't too many that are out there now, but it's not all that different from what you see in, you know, you can buy them at drugstores in particular. You know, these companies that collect packs of cards, and they will either just sell the packs in a box, or they'll open up the packs, take out all the star cards, and then repackage the common cards in these 100 card lots for, you know, $5 or something like that. And, you know, it's typically a lot of cards from the 90s, and, you know, you're only buying them just for the hell of it, really. So anyways, you know, this whole idea of the Super Pack just kind of came about as a money saver. All right, how can we move this leftover product? Well, as things improved gradually throughout the 70s, and as Topps was becoming aware that Fleer was eventually going to become a player in the baseball card business, they needed to refine the Super Pack. So what they did, starting in, I believe it was 1979, they took the 49-cent cello pack. They attached a 3-piece of bubblegum package to the bottom of it, tacked on 10 cents to the retail price, and voila, you have your 59-cent Topps Super Pack. Now, this isn't to be confused with the Super Set, which Topps did release at the same time. That was a series of 5x7 cards. It was a smaller subset, but 5x7 cards, just something that was a little different and unique, and big cards were nothing you know, revolutionary. You had big cards released by Topps. You had the big set. Donruss had a Super Series as well in the 1980s. So don't get the Super Pack confused with the Super Set. Two completely different things here. But the Super Pack would live on for just a few years, 79, 80, and 81 from what I can see. And what's really baffling to me is why Topps didn't continue doing this, especially once Fleer and Donruss came on in 1981. Because part of the legal battle that Topps had with Fleer and Donruss, stage two of the legal battle, if you will, was over the inclusion of bubblegum in the card packs. And that was a legal battle that Topps actually won. They said, no, wait a minute. We're the only company that can put a confectionery item in the baseball cards, Fleer and Donruss. You can't put bubblegum in there like they did in 1981. So, of course, Fleer moves on to the stickers. Donruss moves on to the Perez Steel puzzle pieces. And Topps would have bubblegum in their cards right up into the mid-90s. In some cases, they did skip a couple years. It was at 92 and 93, and then I recall in 94 they packaged it, but they wisely wrapped the slices of gum and put them in there so that you didn't have the gum stains anymore. So as I'm looking at this pack, I unwrap it, and you know, my fingers naturally just go to the bottom where the gum is, and I kind of push down, and I'm like, wait a minute, this gum is soft. How is that possible? We're so used to, if you get an 81 Topps wax pack or a cello pack, you open it up and there's that slab of gum. And of course, it's rock hard because it's a 38-year-old piece of gum. And, you know, I open up this pack and I'm like, oh, these are, you know, first of all, they're not the sticks of gum. They're the cubes of gum. And they're soft. And I'm like, how does this happen? So I decided to venture out there, and even though I tell you not to eat the gum, I actually ate the gum on this package, and it was surprisingly still somewhat tasty and lasted a few minutes, and then I finally just spit it out. But I can see why Topps was able to put in the chunks of gum. First of all, because it was in individual packaging, and it's the normal, like if you've bought a pack of bubble gum, you get the foil packaging, and then the individual pieces are wrapped in wax paper, and that's what was happening with the 81 Topps gum that I was chewing on here. So you could put in the bigger, juicier pieces of gum rather than the dried out stick because it was wrapped differently, but also because you weren't sliding these pieces in between the cards, you could go with the thicker pieces. And because you went with the thicker, juicier pieces, even 38 years later, there was still some flavor to it. There was still some moisture to it, which was actually kind of shocking. It was also, I must caution you, rather gross. Basically, the gum pieces, as I took them out there, they looked like, have you ever left a gumdrop in the sun? Like, have you ever had like a bag of gumdrops in your car and you accidentally leave them in there and the sun beats down on them and they heat up and they just turn into these really gooey, sticky globs of sugar? That is essentially what this bubble gum was. I could have taken it out of the wrapper and wrapped a little seaweed around it and sold it as ahi tuna because it kind of had that look to it. This does not look like regular gum. And as I'm about to put it in my mouth, I'm like, are you really sure you want to do this, Matt? But again, you know, I survived a rather nasty bout of a stomach virus the week before. So I'm like, I'm impervious to illness. I'll chew this gum. But again, it was actually surprisingly decent. And as I'm chewing on this gum, granted 38 years after it was produced, I'm looking at the condition of these cards, which were in great condition other than the off-center cards. But these cards were in great condition because you didn't have that slab of gum not only staining a card, but you also, you know, when you look at the 81 Topps cello packs, they were so tightly wrapped back then that the gum and the wrapping would bow the cards, and it was so easy to damage the corners of the cards even before you opened up the package. I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, well, the packaging held up because it was looser cellophane. You didn't have bubble gum stuck in the middle, and the gum was separate. Plus, you got three pieces, and it was only 10 cents extra. And you know, keeping up the idea that you have a 40% retail markup, okay, so it probably costs tops, what, 5 cents, you know, a pack to add this cluster of gum as opposed to the single stick here. I'm like, well, why didn't they do it? Well, the economy still wasn't totally turned around in 1981. In fact, it would still take a few years for the economy to rebound in America until like 84 or 85 before it was really on the up and up. So, you know, even at 5 cents a pack, you multiply that by, let's say, a million packs. And yeah, that's a pretty good chunk of change there just for a slight change in bubble gum. But again, with Topps holding, cornering the market on the confectionery side and being able to package the bubble gum, and because Topps was at the time the Topps chewing gum company, and the bubble gum was essentially Bazooka bubble gum, which was also marketed separately from the baseball cards, I'm chewing this stuff and I'm looking at these cards and I'm like, why did they not do this? They could have offered up this product for many, many, many years to not only move out essentially the Cello-Pack, but to also push out their gum brand. And they could have kept this going on for years. You know, as the decade of the 80s went on, the price of the Cello-Pack went up. You know, it'd be 69 cents, 79 cents, 89 cents. Well, if you tack on that extra 10 cents for the gum, you know, the kids would still chew the gum. You didn't buy it because of the gum. You bought it because of the baseball cards. But I thought this was a pretty good advantage that Topps had that the competition couldn't have. Fleer couldn't package bubble gum, even though they had their own double bubble line of bubble gum. Leaf couldn't package any candy, even though Leaf, which, you know, became the parent club of Donruss, even though Leaf had, you know, Whoppers candy and stuff like that, they couldn't package it. It was a confectionery item. And of course, you know, Upper Deck and Score and all the other companies that came around later, they couldn't do that. So Topps had this unique edge over the competition, yet they didn't take advantage of it. And that's just rather mysterious to me. Now, Topps, of course, would be just fine despite not having the gum. They would continue to be the leader in the industry throughout the early 80s. Fleer and Donruss got their act together by the mid-80s, and then everybody was caught up in the competition of the late 80s when Score and Upper Deck came around, and of course the hobby got too big to really properly manage. But just looking at the packaging, I thought it was unique. I thought it was a good way for Topps to move the product out there. It gave them an edge, especially in 1981, over Fleer and Donruss. But why they didn't continue that is a little odd to me. I think it's a lost opportunity for Topps. And you know, at the same time, it's a unique collectible for us. You know, like I said, you can get an 81 Topps Super Pack for about $20. And if you don't want to open up the cards, although I found some good ones in the pack I did, you can have a pretty interesting and rather unique combination of the bubble gum and the cards as well. And they're not, you know, interfering with one another, which is a nice change. All right, now, speaking of some of the great cards I got in the pack, I did get an Ozzie Smith card that was in, I would say, mint condition, a Reggie Jackson All-Star card, which was nice. And who saw the picture of the royal family and Reggie Jackson? Did you think the Naked Gun like I did? Of course you did. Must kill the queen. Boy, it took 30 years, but finally, Reggie Jackson in the presence of royalty. That's wonderful. All right, let's talk about some of the players here. I pulled out four cards, starting off with Mickey Klutz. And I had so many great 80s baseball names in this pack. The only 80s baseball name I didn't have were the two I can think of, Rusty Kuntz and Pete LeCocq. But if you can't have a Kuntz or a LeCocq, you can't have a Klutz. And of course, Mickey Klutz, K-L-U-T-T-S, he was a utility infielder, designated hitter, you know, pretty good ball player, had several years in the major leagues, but he is best known as the pet, the teacher's pet for Billy Martin. Klutz was part of the New York Yankees, came up through the Yankees system in the mid-1970s, and became a favorite of Billy Martin. Not only was he a decent hitter and a good utility guy, but also just a hardworking player, a Billy Martin style of ball player. He just wasn't getting thrown into jail for bar fights, at least none that we know of. So when Billy Martin became the manager of the Oakland Athletics in the late 70s and early 80s, guess who was maneuvered from the Yankees to the A's? You guessed it. It was Mickey Klutz. And Billy Martin had that effect on people. He would find these players who just kind of fit his mold, and everywhere that he went, that player would tend to find his way to that team. So Mickey Klutz, even though he didn't have an outstanding career by any stretch of the imagination, certainly was well-loved in the Billy Martin household, if you will, playing from the Yankees from 76 to 78, later Oakland from 79 to 82, and wrapped up his career with the Toronto Blue Jays in 1983, a career 241 hitter. Once the Billy Martin connection ended in 1983 under Bobby Cox in Toronto, that was pretty much it for his career. Now, one other baseball card notable for Mickey Klutz is he is one of a tremendous foursome of a 1970 Topps card. You have the rookie infielders card featuring Hall of Famers Alan Trammell and Paul Molitor, but also Mickey Klutz and a man who made chewing on a toothpick look even badder than Dusty Baker could, of course, talking about UL Washington. So that is one of those must-have baseball cards. I've got a couple of them. You've got, diametrically opposed to each other. You've got Molitor in the upper right corner, Trammell in the lower left, and then in the other corners on the top row, Mickey Klutz, on the bottom row, UL Washington. All right, a great story about Champ Summers. And I joked, I was going through the pack. I said, well, you've got to have a champ on your team, right? That reminds me, there was a pitcher, I think, in the 70s. His name was Win Rimmersall. Well, you got to have a pitcher named Win, right? So if you have a chance to bring in a Champ Summers, you do. Now, Champ was also known as John Summers, John Jr. Summers, but he was called Champ for a number of reasons. The stories that he would tell was that he was such an ugly baby that his father remarked that he looked like, he went up against a champ in Joe Louis, like Joe Louis beat him up and made him look ugly or something like that. There were several odd stories as to how John Summers became Champ Summers, but he did seize on the opportunity to be called Champ throughout his professional career. He was the son of a Navy brat. His father was stationed just outside of Seattle, and that is where Champ Summers grew up. His early childhood was in the Seattle area, and then his family moved to Illinois, and he would become a collegiate star in Illinois. Now, Champ Summers was a natural athlete. He starred in baseball, basketball, football. He lettered in, I think, swimming and diving. I mean, this guy could do anything. And he received tryouts offers from the Dallas Cowboys, the Memphis Tams of the American Basketball Association. He decided to follow in the baseball path, however, goes to college and is not really in a good situation here. He had, by all readings on him that I have, had a little bit of a rough upbringing, was a tough kid, had a little bit of an attitude, and basically punched one of his teammates. So he gets released from college because he's punching his teammates. And as fate would have it, his release from college opened up his draft eligibility in the Vietnam War. Well, that's the draft an athlete doesn't want to get involved in. So he was actually a Vietnam War veteran, served a year overseas, was a paratrooper, also did some more tasks outside of the field. But for Champ Summers, that was a wake-up call. First of all, it brought him down a little bit, brought him down to reality. And then, you know, seeing the death and the destruction around him in Vietnam, and this was a very bad time, too, of the war, too. I want to say it was like 1971. I mean, this is kind of the apex of just the terror of the Vietnam War. Seeing all this, you know, it was a big wake-up call for him in that, you know, he needed to just kind of take life a little less seriously, and life was actually precious to him. And, you know, why be so angry at the world and being so stupid when you can actually be a better person? So he comes back stateside, enrolls at a satellite campus for Southern Illinois University, and he stands out in the baseball world. And, you know, actually got a chance to not only play baseball at Southern Illinois, but also through a semi, or I don't even want to say semi-pro, but through a softball league, he actually got scouted by the Oakland Athletics, not only through, you know, his collegiate baseball, his return to collegiate baseball, but through a softball league as well. So the A's sign him, and he's part of the 1974 World Series team. And as time would go on, he basically, you know, was an overaged rookie. I think he was 27 or 28 when he made his major league debut, was part of that A's team. Eventually moved on to the Cincinnati Reds. Didn't really find a spot in Cincinnati because, of course, you don't have the designated hitter in the National League. So he went back to the minor leagues and was able to hone his craft and actually make a name for himself. Comes back up to Cincinnati, has a pretty decent time there in 77 and 78. But then he gets moved to Detroit, where eventually former Reds manager Sparky Anderson would take over. And as the Tigers are rebuilding and would become a juggernaut in the 1980s, in the late 70s, they were just a little bit of a circus sideshow. But one of the stars of the Tigers team was Champ Summers. And he had a Champ Summers fan club. I think it was Champions, I think is what they were called. They were in right field of Tiger Stadium. And he enjoyed some of his best career years, while with the Tigers in the late 70s and early 80s. Now, eventually, as the Tigers improved, a guy like Champ Summers, who was now in his early 30s and on the downfall, they decided to trade him to the San Francisco Giants for Enos Cabell. And then from the Giants, he would go on to the Padres, where ironically, he would take on the Tigers in the 1984 World Series, was rather mysteriously left off the starting lineup for Kurt Bevecqua. For some reason, Dick Williams put Bevecqua in as the designated hitter for the games in Detroit as opposed to Champ Summers. Champ only had a couple of at-bats in the 84 World Series, and that was pretty much the end of his career. Now, one other notable part of Champ Summers' career, even though the 84 World Series was somewhat forgettable for him, the 84 season wasn't. In fact, Summers was one of the bullies in the many brawls between the Padres and the Braves in the 1984 season. You had a beanball marathon between these two teams throughout the season, and Champ Summers was off the target. In fact, he wanted to go after Pascual Perez in Atlanta during the 84 season, a very ugly bench-clearing brawl in one of those games. And supposedly, he was going to go after some fans as well in the Fulton County Stadium parking lot. So Champ Summers not loved in Atlanta, but definitely loved in Detroit, and certainly that one particular season in San Diego. He would go on to do some coaching, here and there in the minor leagues up until a few years ago. Unfortunately, passed away from kidney cancer just a few years back. He's buried in the Bushnell Memorial Cemetery here in Central Florida as a Vietnam War veteran. So Champ was definitely the people's champ, again, mostly in Detroit, although, again, he certainly had his followers in San Diego for the Bean Brawl Marathon that was going on in the early 1980s. Now, Mike Krukow, that's another great 80s name, Krukow. Of course, Krukow also had a career that spanned from the mid-70s to the late 80s, started with the Chicago Cubs, had a brief stint with the Phillies, but then would star with the San Francisco Giants throughout the 1980s. And Krukow is a all-star, is in the San Francisco Giants Hall of Fame, and is better known nowadays as a broadcaster. He's on the radio team with KMBR. He's been featured in video games. He often jokes with one of his cohorts, Dwayne Kuiper, that he has more home runs as a pitcher than Kuiper had as a position player, which is true, by the way. And unfortunately, Krukow has been dealing with some health issues as well. Back in 2014, he was diagnosed with inclusion body myositis, or IBM, and it's basically a neurological and arthritic dysfunction. It has some mimicking side effects similar to like an ALS. However, it is not as severe. It's not, you know, like ALS, if you get diagnosed with that, that's a death sentence now. But, you know, he feared for many years that he had ALS or was starting to get ALS, but he was diagnosed by the Giants team physician with this IBM. And, you know, unfortunately, it's going to slow him down as he gets older. He's going to need to use a cane or a scooter to get around. Basically, the arthritis in all of his joints gets really, really bad. But he is very, very popular in San Francisco. Had a pretty darn good career as a pitcher as well. As I mentioned, was an all-star in 1989. Came over to the Giants for Joe Morgan. And Morgan helped the Phillies, you know, the Wheeze Kids, as they were known, get to the World Series in 1983. But as the long-term ramifications of the deal worked out, he really helped the Giants solidify their pitching staff and a very good veteran presence throughout the 1980s for the up-and-coming Giants team. All right, so one last great 80s name in this pack of 81 tops, Damaso Garcia. And it's a great picture, too, of Garcia in action. And, you know, he was undersized. He was your typical, you know, utility infielder size guy, little guy from the Dominican Republic. And Damaso Garcia was actually a member of the Yankees for a couple of years in the late 70s, best known for his time in Toronto from 1980 to 86, and would later wrap up his career with the Braves and then the Expos. He was actually a two-time All-Star. Bet you didn't know that. Two-time All-Star Damaso Garcia in 1984 and 85. Also a Silver Slugger winner in 1982, one of the unheralded stars of the Toronto Blue Jays in the 80s. Now, as I mentioned, he was part of the Yankees organization. He was traded with Chris Chambliss and Paul Mirabella to Toronto for Tom Underwood, Rick Cerrone, and Ted Wilborn. And he would be the starting second baseman throughout the mid-1980s. He also batted leadoff for much of his time in Toronto. And eventually, as his skills diminished a little bit, would move on down the batting order. In fact, would, by the end of his time in Toronto, be batting ninth. Of course, that also was part of the the increase in talent that the Blue Jays had in their system there. Now, he also had some problems with manager Jimmy Williams. Boy, you know, Jimmy had a lot of problems with Blue Jays. Not quite George Bell-esque, but Damaso Garcia ran into some issues with Jimmy Williams and eventually did get traded to Atlanta along with Luis Leal in the offseason. Like I said, finished up his career with the Montreal Expos in 1989. Now, an amazing thing about Damaso Garcia, shortly after he retired, he was experiencing double vision and was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Now, they removed the tumor, but doctors at the time said, you only have 6 months to live. Now, when a doctor gives you a cancer diagnosis of that, as I've learned through people that I know who have been diagnosed and died from cancer, typically that is the best case scenario. Take the doctor's prognosis and cut it in half. That's the more realistic timeline there. So if they tell Damaso Garcia you've got 6 months to live, in reality it's like, probably three before it gets really ugly. So basically given a three-month life sentence, now nearly 30 years later, he's still alive. and by all accounts doing well in the Dominican Republic. He runs a baseball camp there for children who have hemophilia, which his oldest son has. So Damaso Garcia, getting that second opportunity in life, and while he is a name that's kind of, I don't want to say forgotten, but, kind of pushed back in the history shelves because he was with a bad Blue Jays team for many years. And even though he did star and was a two-time All-Star there, a lot of people don't really think much of his playing career. Well, after that brain tumor diagnosis, able to take advantage of that second chance at life, not only living and doing well, by all accounts, in the Dominican Republic, but also doing some great charitable work in the name of his son for a condition that afflicts a lot of children and adults, too, but certainly very hard for children to deal with hemophilia. So some very interesting stories from some very interesting names. There are a couple other names in that pack there. Let's see, Jim Morrison. Not of the Doors, but the longtime utility infielder for mostly the White Sox. He would later become a coach there. Like I said, the Jackson and the Smith cards were in there. You also had Tommy Hutton, Ron Oster, another great early 80s name. So a lot of fun opening up that 81 Topps Super Pack. And yeah, actually, it was kind of fun chewing on that disgusting old gum. Although, I'll be honest, even though the gum was bigger and it was juicier and it actually had some flavor to it, I didn't break any teeth. And even though I didn't go into a relapse of my stomach virus by chewing on it, if I buy another Top Super Pack, I'm probably not eating the gum. It's probably just going right into the trash can. But still a great find and an affordable one, too. And of course, 81 Tops, I've talked about that set endlessly. Certainly the best of the three sets from the 1981 series that were released. And one of my favorites with the ball cap on there, the changing colors of the ball cap, nice, simple design, good, easy to read backs as well, and affordable, too. You know, there's a lot of sets from the late 70s and early 80s. It's hard to find affordable packs to open, but you can find some good deals with 81 Tops still 38 years later. Well, there's our look at our Top Super Pack. I want to thank everybody who chimed in with their comments on the program and your questions as well. Again, you can post them at any time at Wax and Gum Stains. And also, you can make your cash donation to keep the program going strong, either through the purchase of packs and cards that we talk about or just through the maintenance of the program, again, at PayPal.me/waxecstatic. Well, what'd I tell you? I'd said the show would be shorter, and sure enough, we're coming up on an hour and a half here. So let me dial it back here. Enjoy your 4th of July weekend, and join us 2 weeks from today. That'll be Friday, July the 19th, as we take a look at some more classic cardboard on Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining me. You think you know, but you don't know. And if you did know, then you would know that I know you'll be glad to join me again in a couple of weeks. You know. All right. We'll see you then. Thank you very much, Jim Mora, and your diddly-poo comments.